today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
3, 2, 1.
Yes!
Shooting those Washington bullets again. Thursday here in the basement, Thursday of Clash Week, which is the greatest week ever in the history of weeks. Thursday means Sandinista.
It does. A triple album.
It also means you're out of Red Stripe.
Yeah, we've moved on to Guinness.
Which means I'm now on to Guinness. Okay. Now, Sandinista being the Clash's fourth studio album.
That's right.
They had a lot of other singles and... Did Black Market Clash come out before this or after this?
Came out
the
around...
compilation?
Yeah, somewhere in this sort of gap, right? That picked up all the stuff that wasn't on the two first albums and was B-sides and cool songs.
Right.
And, you know, had stuff like, I don't know.
Right. So, I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
You're listening to Rock in the Suburbs. We're going through these Clash albums. Before we get to our take on Sandinista, we have... some comments here from some of our listeners on social media when they heard somehow we were going to talk about the Clash.
They said, where they heard that.
I got to get in on this.
Yeah.
So Bradley Davis responded to us on Facebook. And first thing I got to say is, according to his Facebook page, it says, pronounce his name B-Rad Davis. His cover photo on Facebook is just like the double bass drums that say the Who on each one. Yeah, so it's great. Okay. So what he had to say about the Clash, he says, when asked about his favorite Clash album, he says, as time goes on, I'd say Sandinista. Of all things, the album I played only a handful of songs during my youth has become my go-to album these days.
Interesting.
Is it as good as London Calling or the debut or Give Them Enough Rope? Who knows? Probably not, especially Calling. Does it feel like it could have been released recently? Yes. And it's got the Street Parade on it.
Well, I was waiting for your phone call, the one that never called, like a man about to bust. I was dying.
Okay, there you go, Bradley.
Or what is that, like a side five or a side four? I can't remember.
That's a side five.
Okay.
So, yes. So, Sandinista, the rare triple album in rock and roll, coming off of a double album.
Right. The record company was not happy about this, Jim. They did not want to release a triple album, especially the Clash's management at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which was no longer Bernie Rhodes, some sort of a conglomerate or partnership called Black Hill Enterprises or something like that. And they said, no way.
Right. So it's, I think, somewhat divisive,
yeah.
I think, among fans because, first of all, I just love the fact that when you hold it up, it shows, you know, the track listing on the back cover. Six sides,
yeah.
Each one with six,
six
songs.
Times
it's
six,
so perfect.
Right. 48 songs, yeah.
Or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, it's kind of divisive. There's a lot of Clash fans who feel like maybe it's too much, that they would have done better to pare it down.
Sure.
We did get a couple of comments here on Twitter about this album from people who are fans of Sandinista, because it does have a lot of hardcore fans who love this record.
Yeah.
But here's some of the comments they say. One from Eli Paname, who says his favorite Clash album is Sandinista. Who else could put out a triple album with five good sides of material?
It yes.
broke the mold, right?
That's right.
And then Scott Boykin says, I'll go with London Calling as my favorite. However, if Sandinista was a double instead of a triple album, I might have gone in another direction.
Hmm. Interesting.
And I've heard that from people before that, you know, maybe this would have been better as a double album, what have you. Mm-hmm. I personally, here's my take on Sandinista. Okay. And when I was a freshman in college, my college roommate, freshman year in the dorm, was one of those like random people you get paired up with.
Yeah.
And we were not exactly compatible in a lot of ways.
Sure.
I was like, you know, a skinny guy from Ohio who
yeah.
was completely unathletic, and he was on the wrestling team.
Oh boy. And so, you're difficult to get along with.
Well, there's that too. Now it comes out, right? Right? Okay. But anyway, he was really into Sandinista.
Yeah.
And so that was my exposure
to it.
Gotta
listen to this. Yeah.
Right. And I'm kind of like Bradley Davis saying, I don't know if this is my go-to record, but it's the kind of record that you can have for years or decades and go back and listen to and appreciate yeah. it and find new things. And if there's any band I will give, you know, I will cut some slack for being maybe overindulgent. Coming off of those first three albums, I'll give it to The Clash,
yeah.
you know, because
sure.
they had already established their credibility. They established themselves as a band that wanted to try new things, wanted to really experiment with different sounds.
Yeah.
And, you know, this to me is sort of like the culmination of that mm-hmm. in a large extent. It's like, you know, they're trying out a lot of different stuff. Does it always work great? No, it's not London Calling, but it's a really fascinating album.
Mm-hmm. Well said, Jim. Yeah, you covered a lot of things I wanted to say there. And I will also say really quickly to the single record debate, sure, I understand that it's fun to kind of mix records up and kind of figure it out. If you're a Super Clash fan, you know, it's fun to play that game. To me, it's like a crossword puzzle. Can I work this Clash crossword puzzle and pick out a cool one disc Sandinista? Sure, I can do that. But that doesn't matter in the end, right? It doesn't matter because, like you said, again, the band is trying to exert their independence from the record company. All right, we're going to be on a big label, mm-hmm. but we're still going to do it our way.
Right.
We're going to put out a three record set if we want to.
And call it Sandinista.
Right, and we'll forego all of our royalties if you want us to, you know, challenge us. Sure, we'll do that. We don't care. We'll give up every penny, you know, that we could possibly make on this triple set, and we'll sell it for a super low price, which is a very Fugazi kind of thing to do, you
right.
know, maybe 15 years before that, right? And, you know, it's probably, you know, to one of those comments, so far ahead of its time that was hard to understand. I mean, they started the record in New York with, again, no songs, and they went into the studio and started jamming and writing songs, right? Paul Simonin was actually filming a movie. He didn't even start the record with them. They had a couple, like, substitute bass players who apparently wrote the riff for the Magnificent Seven. So they were just kind of jamming, and they just continued to jam for about 8 months. There's guest voices on the record. Mickey Dredd plays a big part. Mickey Gallagher, right? There were mixes. There was dub all of a sudden, out-and-out dub. They had one version of the song on one side, and then three sides later, there's another version of the song,
right.
but it's kind of a backwards dub, you know, spaced out version of the song. It was just everything and anything. And yeah, that's way ahead of its time, especially think of like hip hop mixtapes or, you know, Mad Villain or something like that, or, you know, MF Doom, where they just remixed and chewed everything back up and spit it out. And that was an album.
Let me interrupt you right there and, you know, let's dance.
Okay.
Bankers too. Let's get up and learn those.
rules. When a man and a crazy chief, one says sun and one says sleep. AM and FM, the PM too, turning out that boogaloo. Get you up and I guess you out, but how long can you keep it up? Give me Honda, give me Sonic, so cheap and real phony. Hong Kong dollar, Indian cents, English pounds and Eskimo pence.
That's side one of six, track one.
Yeah.
And let's just look at these records that we've already talked about earlier in the week for a second here, right? And you got to remember, kids, if you listen to Spotify or iTunes or whatever, and you can just put stuff on shuffle, you can listen to any song, you can make playlists, you can listen to any order, whatever. Back then, with physical albums, you tended to always start with the first song the first side, right? You weren't going, skipping around, moving into the middle.
It was designed that way.
Right. So it was designed that way, and sequencing was really important. And, you know, side one, track one was important to sort of set the tone of the record. So if you go back to the Clash's debut, it starts with Janie Jones on the UK version. On the American version, Clash City Rockers.
Yeah, right? Well.
Yeah. Again, you know, establishing that album.
Sure.
Then on Give Him Enough Rope, it's Safe European Home, another, you know, kind of straight on rock song. Yep. Then London Calling is London Calling, which is a great rock song. Then on Sandinista, it's this hip hop, right?
The Magnificent Seven.
It's like saying to the listeners, to the true fans, like we've touched on all these different influences. We've done a lot of different styles. We've done, you know, all this stuff on different songs on our albums, but this is what this album is going to be about.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. Statement of purpose. Totally. Right. Yeah. And absorbed, you know, so many influences. And one to me, Jim, that really helps me contextualize this record is that at the time, the hottest thing in New York was this sort of disco derived discovery of a 12 inch record. Right. Mm-hmm. So you had a 12 inch that had one song, and when you played it, the grooves were wider and the record just sounded bigger and sounded louder. And, you know, it was designed to pump on a dance floor and it was designed for DJs to be able to mix easier and all that. But the Clash fell in love with that idea, right? That you could extend something and make it deeper and bigger. And to me, they tried to make six sides of 12 inches. They just tried to make these expansive, fat sounding, big sounding records with experimental things on top, you know, like a DJ might remix. And that's how I think of Sandinista. And I think some of it is brilliant. Some of it is a little ponderous and maybe a little too chill, but most of it is pretty great. And I can see how some of our listeners would say, I didn't get it when it first came out, or it was too much for me. Like, that's how I felt, you know, it overwhelmed me. I never understood it. But I can see now, absorbing all the influences that came between, going back to it and being like, oh man, this is my favorite record, right? Because it said everything like 10 years ago. I just didn't know what they were saying.
It's that kind of an album. Yeah. I, you know, the great music critic, rock critic, Robert Christgau said, quote, if this is their worst, they must be the world's greatest rock and roll band.
What a great point.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to that sprawling ambition, one of the things that's I really love about this record is this cover of this weird old blues song from the 50s called Junko Partner, right? Which turned out at one point to be like a folk thing and at one point to be like a almost a weird reggae thing, but also originally was a blues thing. And it was kind of like we were talking about with London Calling. There was this deep sense of America, this weird old America, as Gruel Marcus might say, that goes back beyond Elvis and Sun Records into those deep, mysterious connections between the blues and jazz and rock and roll, and the Clash seemed to know about those. Mm-hmm. So they didn't completely lose that thread on Sandinista that they had on London Calling. But here, they almost put like a reggae dub style on it. So they're creating like this amazing hybrid music, Jim.
Down the road, came a junko partner. Boy, he was loaded. He was a waggling,
over the street. Singing 6 months, ain't no sentence.
What is that instrument? Do you know?
I don't know if it's a melodica or some sort of high-tuned keyboard, but it's something very Jamaican-sounding,
yeah,
and something very dub-sounding. And they got a lot of interesting studio effects on this record that they put to use. You know, to me, Jim, like if that came out on, like, say, I don't know, a Kendrick Lamar record today, you wouldn't even raise an eyebrow. But in 1980, that's a pretty futuristic-sounding record.
That's
it was
a
mixing
great point.
Dub, rap, guitar, all kinds of weird stuff.
That's like a great point. We're kind of spoiled today
by
what, you know, people are able to do and how easily they are able to sort of meld things and experiment. But yeah, think about this at the time.
I know. It's amazing.
Like, I think that's part of the reason why it's kind of a divisive record, because I'm sure for a lot of people, it's just like, what is this?
Hard
they
to swallow. Yeah.
They couldn't, you know, wrap their heads around it, right?
Exactly. And that's part of the, you know, the thing that makes this record great. And it is a great record. Is the bravery the Clash showed to their own vision. They decided that the stuff they would jam up and put together with session players was good enough, and they believed enough in their vision and themselves to put it out, and they did it.
Yep, totally agree. Okay, let's take a quick little break here, and we're going to get back and play a couple more songs from this record, because there's only like 33 more.
That's right. Hey, Jim, what are you doing?
You know, I'm just surfing the web, and
oh, cool.
I happened upon this website called Rockin' the Suburbs. It's at suburbspod.com.
Ah, that's a great website. What a good URL.
It has little recaps of this really cool show.
Mm-hmm.
You can check that out. And then there's also this one great part where you click on it and you get Rickrolled.
Sounds like a fun destination for all.
It's really fun. You go there, you just type in then the little bar up at the top,
mm-hmm,
suburbspod.com. That's it.
And it takes you there.
It's free.
Okay. So you use your dial-up. First you dial in to the internet.
Yep.
Get that going. And
yep,
you go to suburbspod.com.
Yep. And you will never leave. And we're back.
Mm-hmm.
And the next song I want to play, I don't even know how to get into this. Well, first of all, before we do that, let me just mention some of the other songs that we're not going to play, right? Somebody Got Murdered.
No. We're not going to play that.
We're not going to play that, but that's more of sort of a classic sort of Clash song.
Yeah,
that's what you
exactly
would expect more from that, but it's got a great melody.
Great song.
And it's a great song. Let me mention also Charlie Don't Surf.
Yeah.
Right? Which is reference to Vietnam, right?
Yeah, Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
apparently
Apocalypse
the
Now
band was super fascinated with that movie. And I think, you know, maybe the next record we're going to talk about had an even heavier Vietnam vibe. But
right.
There were some strains poking up here and there on this record.
That's right. Hitsville, UK, which you and I were listening to before we started recording.
We were talking about that. Released as a single in some parts of the world, right?
That's right.
That had Mick Jones's girlfriend, Ellen Foley, I believe, singing lead.
It's such a bizarre song to release as a single.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I think she sang on Bad Out of Hell.
Oh, is that right?
I think so, somewhere along the line.
Okay. But obviously a reference to Motown.
Yeah.
And a Motown kind of
sounding
song.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then the one I want to pick here,
mm-hmm,
is Washington Bullets.
Okay.
Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. The shooting goes. Washington Bullets again. Every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember a landing in the days before.
the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Verdad. Those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy and the Cuban Sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color, the bullet you spray of lead.
It's about basketball, right?
I think so, yeah. The original Washington Wizards.
Yeah, that's right. They won the championship in 1978. We all had bullets fever, as
exactly
Nils Lofgren told us.
Elvin Hayes.
And so 2 years later, the Clash write a song about how great that team was.
Seems pretty normal.
Wes Unseld.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think I think that's funny because, I mean, obviously, it's a play on the team's name.
Sure.
But very smartly done, you know, yeah, being a political song about,
absolutely,
you know, our involvement in other countries, you know, militarily, mm-hmm, right? And it, and here's a funny story about that is just the other day I was talking with the boy,
yeah,
12 years old, my 12 year old son, and he's a huge, huge NBA fan.
Yes, he is.
And so I was, and the Wizards are his favorite team. And so I was telling him, hey, the Clash wrote this song called Washington Bullets, but it's not about basketball. And as I was explaining to him about what it's about, and I was like, you know, you get it like Washington and like the military, like,
sure,
like before I could even finish the sentence, he's like, yeah, Dad, I get it. Okay, that was it.
Speed up,
Dad. That's right.
That's a great story.
So there you go.
Well, you know, and he makes a good point, the boy, because, you know, the Clash were taking on some world political situations on this record, right? And I think the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 helped the Clash out sort of retroactively, right? Because he enacted a lot of policies that cast light on some of the songs they were singing at that,
right,
point, right? And Strummer was always very political and all about the you know, the common man finding a place in this world and having some power to do something about it if he didn't.
Right. And again, going back to the fact they named the album Sandinista,
right,
shows that, you know, they're very aware of what's happening in the world and very sympathetic to, you know, the sensitive political, you know, struggles that are going on in Central America here. But, you know, a lot of songs are about the Middle East.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm, very much aware of sort of the, you know, geopolitical complexities of the world, right?
Yeah, the landscape. And I think that they influenced in such an amazing way one of my favorite bands, the Minutemen, right? Mm-hmm. The way Dee Boone wrote about Central America, mm-hmm, and politics, he took from Joe Strummer and these kind of lyrics in a smart way, though. He didn't pander to them or try to ape their style, but he translated it to his own vision, right? Him and Mike Watt, they worked it out in maybe the same way that Jones and Strummer would, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so I know we have a lot more songs that we could play here.
We could be here all night.
I don't think we're going to do that.
Mm-mm.
But I would encourage, I really would encourage listeners, you know, a lot of you probably know the debut album, probably know London Calling,
yeah,
of course. You know, if you're into streaming services, things like that, go and listen to this album, but sit down and listen to it, like,
yeah,
like top to bottom.
Do,
I think you'll really be in for a treat, and I think it's the way this is meant to be listened to.
Do one of those Tug Baker things where you challenge yourself,
yes,
to a month with Sandinista, really? I mean, you could do it, and you'd learn a lot.
Yes. And if you want to have a Red Stripe?
Buy yourself a six-pack of Red Stripe and listen to Sandinista. You could do
ahead
worse for a weekend.
Yeah. One beer per side.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So listen to Rock in the Suburbs.
Every day.
Every day, especially this week. It's Clash Week. This is our penultimate episode,
yeah,
of Clash Week. Tomorrow we're going to go out with Combat Rock, so you're not going to want to miss that. You can also find us on the web at suburbspod.com and the show on all the podcast platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And you can call our Suburban Party Line, talk about the Clash or other things, 612-440-1984. Or email us rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter at suburbspod.
You do that well.
And Patrick, what are we going to play out with?
Well, here? We're going to play out with something that I think emphasizes what we talked about, which was kind of a weird jumble of a lot of thoughts and feelings, which is what Sandinista is. But, you know, I was saying they did this old blues song, right? Junko Partner.
Right.
But they also did some great reggae and you know, made it Clash style. So for me, outside of White Man, you know, which was an original, this is the best kind of reggae punk song that Clash ever did.
They're one of the greatest ever cover bands in terms of digging up obscure songs, right?
Yes.
You know, there are so many songs where you listen to them and you think, like, that's a great Clash song. And it's only sometime later that you find out it's a cover song. And I think this is a perfect example of it, right? This is a deep cut.
Exactly right.
All right. So what is it?
This is Police on My Back. That train whistle always freaked me out because I used to listen to that really loud in my car and I would be like, what the hell just happened? Someone trying to pull me over? Someone honking at me?
Right, right.
Yeah. Did I just cross the median?